Chapter 12. On a particularly cold morning in late November, Vian woke with tears on her cheeks. She had been dreaming about Antoine again. With a sigh, she eased out of bed, taking care not to waken Sophie. Vian had slept fully dressed, wearing a woolen vest, a long-sleeved sweater, woolen stockings, a pair of flannel pants, Antoine's cut down to fit her, and a knit cap and mittens. It wasn't even Christmas, and already layering had become de rigueur. She added a cardigan, and still she was cold. She burrowed her mittened hands into the slit at the foot of the mattress and withdrew the leather pouch Antoine had left for her. Not much money remained in it. Soon they would have to live on her teaching salary alone. She returned the money. Counting it had become an obsession since the weather turned cold, and went downstairs. There was never enough of anything anymore. The pipes froze at night, and so there was no water until midday. Vian had taken to leaving buckets full of water positioned near the stove and fireplaces for washing. Gas and electricity were scarce, as was money to pay for them, so she was miserly with both. The flames on her stove were so low it barely boiled water. They rarely turned on the lights. She made a fire and then wrapped herself in a heavy eiderdown and sat on the divan. Beside her was a bag of yarn that she'd collected by pulling apart one of her old sweaters. She was making Sophie a scarf for Christmas, and these early morning hours were the only time she could find. With only the creaking of the house for company, she focused on the pale blue yarn and the way the knitting needles dove in and out of the soft strands, creating every moment something that hadn't existed before. It calmed her nerves, this once ordinary morning ritual. If she loosed her thoughts, she might remember her mother sitting beside her, teaching her, saying, "Knit one, purl two. That's right. Beautiful." Or Antoine, coming down the stairs in his stockinged feet, smiling, asking her what she was making for him. Antoine. The front door opened slowly, bringing a burst of ice-cold air and a flurry of leaves. Isabel came in, wearing Antoine's old wool coat and knee-high boots and a scarf that coiled around her head and neck, obscuring all but her eyes. She saw Vian and came to a sudden stop. "Oh! You're up!" She unwound the scarf and hung up her coat. There was no mistaking the guilty look on her face. "I was out checking on the chickens." Vian's hands stilled. The needles paused. "You might as well tell me who he is, this boy you keep sneaking out to meet."
"Who would meet a boy in this cold?"
Isabel went to Vian, pulling her to her feet, leading her to the fire. At the sudden warmth, Vian shivered. She hadn't realized how cold she'd been. "You," she said, surprised that it made her smile.
"You would sneak out in the cold to meet a boy." "He would have to be some boy. Clark Gable, maybe."
Sophie rushed into the room, snuggling up to Vian.
"This feels good," she said, holding her hands out.
For a beautiful, tender moment, Vian forgot her worries. And then Isabel said,
"Well, I'd best go. I need to be first in the butcher's queue."
"You need to eat something before you go," Vian said.
"Give mine to Sophie,"
Isabel answered, pulling the coat back on and rewinding the scarf around her head. Vian walked her sister to the door, watched her slip out into the darkness, then returned to the kitchen and lit an oil lamp, and went down to the cellar pantry, where rows of shelving ran along the stone wall. 2 years ago, this pantry had been full to overflowing with ham smoked in ash and jars full of duck fat set beside coils of sausage, bottles of aged champagne vinegar, tins of sardines, jars of jam. Now they were nearly to the end of the chicory coffee. The last of the sugar was a sparkly white residue in the glass container, and the flour was more precious than gold.
Thank God the garden had produced a good crop of vegetables in spite of the war refugees' rampage. She had canned and preserved every single fruit and vegetable, no matter how undersized. She reached for a piece of wholemeal bread that was about to go bad. As breakfast for growing girls went, a boiled egg and a piece of toast wasn't much, but it could be worse.
"I want more," Sophie said when she'd finished.
"I can't," Vian said.
"The Germans are taking all of our food,"
Sophie said, just as Beck emerged from his room, dressed in his gray-green uniform.
"Sophie," Vian said sharply.
"Well, it is true, young lady, that we German soldiers are taking much of the food France produces. But men who are fighting need to eat, do they not?"
Sophie frowned up at him.
"Doesn't everyone need to eat?"
"Oui, mademoiselle. And we Germans do not only take, we give back to our friends."
He reached into the pocket of his uniform and drew out a chocolate bar.
"Chocolate!" "Sophie, no," Vian said.
But Beck was charming her daughter, teasing her as he made the chocolate bar disappear and reappear by sleight of hand. At last, he gave it to Sophie, who squealed and ripped the paper off. Beck approached Vian.
"You look sad this morning," he said quietly.
Vian didn't know how to respond. He smiled and left. Outside, she heard his motorcycle start up and putter away.
"That was good chocolate," Sophie said, smacking her lips. "You know, it would have been a good idea to have a small piece each night rather than to gobble it all up at once. And I shouldn't have to mention the virtues of sharing. Tante Isabel says it's better to be bold than meek. She says if you jump off a cliff, at least you'll fly before you fall."
"Ah, yes, that sounds like Isabel. Perhaps you should ask her about the time she broke her wrist jumping from a tree she shouldn't have been climbing in the first place. Come on, let's go to school." Outside, they waited at the side of the muddy, icy road for Rachel and the children. Together, they set off on the long, cold walk to school.
"I ran out of coffee 4 days ago," Rachel said. "In case you've been wondering why I've been such a witch."
"I'm the one who has been short-tempered lately," Vian said. She waited for Rachel to disagree, but Rachel knew her well enough to know when a simple statement wasn't so simple.
"It's that I've had some things on my mind."
The list. She'd written the names down weeks ago, and nothing had come of it. Still, worry lingered.
"Antoine? Starvation? Freezing to death?"
Rachel smiled.
"What small worry has obsessed you this week?"
The school bell pealed.
"Hurry, Maman, we are late,"
Sophie said, grabbing her by the arm, dragging her forward. Vian let herself be led up the stone steps. She and Sophie and Sarah turned into Vian's classroom, which was already filled with students.
"You're late, Madame Mauriac,"
Gilles said with a smile.
"That's one demerit for you."
Everyone laughed. Vian took off her coat and hung it up.
"You are very humorous, Gilles, as usual. Let's see if you're still smiling after our spelling test."
This time they groaned, and Vian couldn't help smiling at their crestfallen faces. They all looked so disheartened. It was difficult, honestly, to feel otherwise in this cold, blacked-out room that didn't have enough light to dispel the shadows.
"Oh, what the heck? It's a cold morning. Maybe a game of tag is what we need to get our blood running."
A roar of approval filled the room. Vian barely had time to grab her coat before she was swept out of the classroom on a tide of laughing children. They had only been outside a few moments when Vian heard the grumble of automobiles coming toward the school. The children didn't notice. They only noticed aeroplanes these days, it seemed, and went on with their play. Vian walked down to the end of the building and peered around the corner. A black Mercedes-Benz roared up the dirt driveway, its fenders decorated with small swastika flags that flapped in the cold. Behind it was a French police car.
"Children,
Vian said, rushing back to the courtyard. Come here, stand by me.
Two men rounded the corner and came into view. One she had never seen before. He was a tall, elegant, almost effete blonde man, wearing a long black leather coat and spit-shined boots. An iron cross decorated his stand-up collar. The other man she knew. He had been a policeman in Karivo for years, Paul Jolaire. Antoine had often remarked that he had a mean and cowardly streak.
Madame Mauriac, the French police officer said with an officious nod.
She didn't like the look in his eyes. It reminded her of how boys sometimes looked at each other when they were about to bully a weaker child.
Bonjour, Paul.
We are here for some of your colleagues. There is nothing to concern you, madame. You are not on our list.
List.
What do you want with my colleagues? She heard herself asking, but her voice was almost inaudible, even though the children were silent.
Some teachers will be dismissed today.
Dismissed? Why?
The Nazi agent flicked his pale hand as if he were batting at a fly.
Jews and communists and Freemasons. Others, he sneered, who are no longer permitted to teach school or work in civil service or in the judiciary.
But...
The Nazi nodded at the French policeman, and the two turned as one and marched into the school.
Madame Mauriac,
someone said, tugging on her sleeve.
Maman,
Sophie said, whining.
They can't do that, can they?
Course they can,
Gilles said.
Damn Nazi bastards.
Vian should have disciplined him for his language, but she couldn't think of anything except the list of names she'd given to Beck. Vian wrestled with her conscience for hours. She'd continued teaching for much of the day, although she couldn't remember how. All that stuck in her mind was the look Rachel had given her as she walked out of the school with the other dismissed teachers. Finally at noon, although they were already shorthanded at school, Vian had asked another teacher to take over her classroom. Now, she stood at the edge of the town square. All the way here, she had planned what she would say, but when she saw the Nazi flag flying above the Hôtel de Ville, her resolve faltered. Everywhere she looked, there were German soldiers, walking in pairs, or riding gorgeous, well-fed horses, or darting up the streets in shiny black Citroëns. Across the square, a Nazi blew his whistle and used his rifle to force an old man to his knees.
Go, Vian.
She walked up the stone steps to the closed oak doors, where a fresh-faced young guard stopped her and demanded to know her business.
I am here to see Captain Beck, she said.
Ah.
The guard opened the door for her and pointed up the wide stone staircase, making the number 2 with his fingers. Vian stepped into the main room of the town hall. It was crowded with men in uniforms. She tried not to make eye contact with anyone as she hurried across the lobby to the stairs, which she ascended under the watchful eyes of the Führer, whose portrait took up much of the wall. On the second floor, she found a man in uniform, and she said to him,
Captain Beck, s'il vous plaît?
Oui, madame.
He showed her to a door at the end of the hall and rapped smartly upon it. At a response from within, he opened the door for her. Beck was seated behind an ornate black and gold desk, obviously taken from one of the grand homes in the area. Behind him, a portrait of Hitler and a collection of maps were affixed to the walls. On his desk was a typewriter and a Ronio machine. In the corner stood a pile of confiscated radios, but worst of all was the food. There were boxes and boxes of food, heaps of cured meats and wheels of cheese stacked against the back wall.
Madame Mauriac, he said, rising quickly. What a most pleasant surprise.
He came toward her.
What may I do for you?
It is about the teachers you fired at the school.
Not I, madame.
Vian glanced at the open door behind them and took a step toward him, lowering her voice to say,
You told me the list of names was clerical in nature.
I am sorry, truly. This is what I was told.
We need them at the school.
Your being here, it is dangerous, perhaps.
He closed the small distance between them.
You do not want to draw attention to yourself, Madame Mauriac. Not here. There is a man.
He glanced at the door and stopped speaking.
Go, madame.
I wish you hadn't asked me.
As do I, madame.
He gave her an understanding look.
Now, go. Please. You should not be here.
Vian turned away from Captain Beck, and all that food and the picture of the Führer, and left his office. On her way down the stairs, she saw how the soldiers observed her, smiling to one another, no doubt joking about another French woman courting a dashing German soldier who had just broken her heart. But it wasn't until she stepped back out into the sunshine that she realized fully her mistake. Several women were in the square or near it, and they saw her step out of the Nazis' lair. One of the women was Isabel. Vian hurried down the steps toward Hélène Ruel, the baker's wife, who was delivering bread to the commandanteur.
"Socializing, Madame Mauriac?"
Hélène said archly as Vian rushed past her. Isabel was practically running across the square toward her. With a defeated sigh, Vian came to a standstill, waiting for her sister to reach her.
"What are you doing in there?"
Isabel demanded, her voice too loud, or maybe that was only to Vian's ears.
"They fired the teachers today. No, not all of them, just the Jews and the Freemasons and the Communists."
The memory welled up in her, made her feel sick. She remembered the quiet hallway and the confusion among the teachers who remained. No one knew what to do, how to defy the Nazis.
"Just them, huh?"
Isabel said, her face tightening.
"I didn't mean it to sound that way. I meant to clarify, they didn't fire all the teachers."
Even to her own ears, it sounded a feeble excuse, so she shut up.
"And this says nothing to explain your presence at their headquarters."
"I thought Captain Beck could help us, help Rachel."
"You went to Beck for a favor?"
"I had to."
"French women do not ask Nazis for help, Vian. Mon Dieu, you must know this."
"I know," Vian said defiantly. "But..."
"But what?"
Vian couldn't hold it in anymore.
"I gave him a list of names."
Isabel went very still. For an instant, she seemed not to be breathing. The look she gave Vian stung more than a slap across the face.
"How could you do that? Did you give him Rachel's name?"
I didn't know," Vian stammered. "How could I know? He said it was clerical."
She grabbed Isabel's hand.
"Forgive me, Isabel, truly, I didn't know."
"It is not my forgiveness you need to seek, Vian."
Vian felt a stinging, profound shame. How could she have been so foolish? And how in God's name could she make amends? She glanced at her wristwatch. Classes would be ending soon.
"Go to the school," Vian said. "Get Sophie and Sarah and take them home. There's something I need to do."
"Whatever it is, I hope you've thought it through."
"Go,"
Vian said tiredly. The Chapel of St. Jean was a small stone Norman church at the edge of town. Behind it, and within its medieval walls, lay the convent of the Sisters of St. Joseph, nuns who ran both an orphanage and a school. Vian went into the church, her footsteps echoing on the cold stone floor, her breath plumed in front of her. She took off her mittens just long enough to touch her fingertips to the frozen holy water. She made the sign of the cross and went to an empty pew. She genuflected and then knelt. Closing her eyes, she bent her head in prayer. She needed guidance and forgiveness. But for the first time in her life, she could find no words for her prayer.
How could she be forgiven for such a foolish, thoughtless act? God would see her guilt and fear, and he would judge her. She lowered her clasped hands and climbed back up to sit on the wooden pew.
Vian Moyag, is that you?
Mother Superior Marie-Thérèse moved in beside Vian and sat down. She waited for Vian to speak. It had always been this way between them. The first time Vian had come to Mother for advice, Vian had been 16 years old and pregnant. It had been Mother who comforted Vian after Papa had called her a disgrace. Mother, who had planned for a rushed wedding and talked Papa into letting Vian and Antoine have Le Jardin. Mother, who'd promised Vian that a child was always a miracle and that young love could endure.
You know there is a German billeted at my house,
Vian said finally.
They are at all of the big homes and in every hotel.
He asked me which of the teachers at school were Jewish or communist or Freemasons.
Ah, and you answered him.
That makes me the fool Isabel calls me, doesn't it?
You are no fool, Vian.
She gazed at Vian.
And your sister is quick to judge. That much I remember about her.
I ask myself if they would have found these names without my help. They have dismissed Jews from positions all over town.
Do you not know this? Monsieur Penoir is not the postmaster anymore, and Judge Breillat has been replaced. I have had news from Paris that the headmistress of College Sevigny was forced to resign, as have all of the Jewish singers at the Paris Opera. Perhaps they needed your help, perhaps they did not. Certainly they would have found the names without your help,
Mother said in a voice that was both gentle and stern.
But that is not what matters.
What do you mean?
I think as this war goes on, we will all have to look more deeply. These questions are not about them, but about us.
Vian felt tears sting her eyes.
I don't know what to do anymore. Antoine always took care of everything. The Wehrmacht and the Gestapo are more than I can handle.
Don't think about who they are. Think about who you are and what sacrifices you can live with and what will break you.
It's all breaking me. I need to be more like Isabel. She is so certain of everything. This war is black and white for her. Nothing seems to scare her.
Isabel will have her crisis of faith in this too, as will we all. I have been here before in the Great War. I know the hardships are just beginning. You must stay strong.
By believing in God.
Yes, of course, but not only by believing in God. Prayers and faith will not be enough, I'm afraid. The path of righteousness is often dangerous. Get ready, Vian. This is only your first test. Learn from it.
Mother leaned forward and hugged Vian again. Vian held on tightly, her face pressed to the scratchy wool habit. When she pulled back, she felt a little better. Mother Superior stood, took Vian's hand, and drew her to a stand.
Perhaps you could find the time to visit the children this week and give them a lesson? They loved it when you taught them painting. As you can imagine, there's a lot of grumbling about empty bellies these days. Praise the Lord, the sisters have an excellent garden and the goat's milk and cheese is a godsend. Still...
Yes,
Vian said. Everyone knew about how the belt tightening felt, especially to children.
You're not alone, and you're not the one in charge,
Mother said gently.
Ask for help when you need it, and give help when you can.
I think that is how we serve God,
and each other, and ourselves, in times as dark as these.
You're not the one in charge.
Vian contemplated Mother's words all the way home. She had always taken great comfort in her faith. When Maman had first begun to cough, and then when that coughing deepened into a hacking shudder, that left sprays of blood on handkerchiefs, Vian had prayed to God for all that she needed. Help, guidance, a way to cheat the death that had come to call. At 14, she'd promised God anything, everything, if he would just spare her mamaw's life. With her prayers unanswered, she returned to God and prayed for the strength to deal with the aftermath, her loneliness, Papa's bleak, angry silences and drunken rages, Isabel's wailing neediness. Time and again, she had returned to God, pleading for help, promising her faith. She wanted to believe that she was neither alone nor in charge, but rather that her life was unfolding according to his plan, even if she couldn't see it. Now, though, such hope felt as slight and bendable as tin. She was alone, and there was no one else in charge, no one but the Nazis. She had made a terrible, grievous mistake. She couldn't take it back, however much she might hope for such a chance. She couldn't undo it. But a good woman would accept responsibility, and blame, and apologize. Whatever else she was or wasn't, whatever her failings, she intended to be a good woman. And so she knew what she needed to do. She knew it. And still, when she came to the gate at Rachel's cottage, she found herself unable to move. Her feet felt heavy, her heart even more so. She took a deep breath and knocked on the door. There was a shuffling of feet within, and then the door opened. Rachel held her sleeping son in one arm and had a pair of dungarees slung over the other.
"Vian," she said, smiling. "Come in."
Vian almost gave in to cowardice.
"Oh, Rachel, I just stopped by to say hello."
Instead, she took a deep breath and followed her friend into the house. She took her usual place in the comfortable upholstered chair tucked in close to the blazing fire.
"Take Ari, I'll make us coffee."
Vian reached for the sleeping baby and took him in her arms. He snuggled close, and she stroked his back and kissed the back of his head.
"We heard that some of the care packages were being delivered to prisoner of war camps by the Red Cross,"
Rachel said a moment later, coming into the room carrying two cups of coffee. She set one down on the table next to Vian.
"Where are the girls?"
"At my house, with Isabel. Probably learning how to shoot a gun."
Rachel laughed.
"There are worse skills to have."
She pulled the dungarees from her shoulder and tossed them onto a straw basket with the rest of her sewing. Then she sat down across from Vian. Vian breathed in deeply of the sweet scent that was pure baby. When she looked up, Rachel was staring at her.
"Is it one of those days?"
she asked quietly. Vian gave an unsteady smile. Rachel knew how much Vian sometimes mourned her lost babies, and how deeply she'd prayed for more children. It had been difficult between them, not a lot, but a little, when Rachel had gotten pregnant with Ari. There was joy for Rachel, and a thread of envy.
"No," she said. She lifted her chin slowly, looked her best friend in the eyes. "I have something to tell you."
"What?"
Vian drew in a breath.
"Do you remember the day we wrote the postcards, and Captain Beck was waiting for me when we got home?"
"We? I offered to come in with you."
"I wish you had, although I don't suppose it would have made a difference. He just would have waited until you left."
Rachel started to rise.
"Did he?"
"No, no," she said quickly. "Not that. He was working at the dining room table that day, writing something when I returned. He asked me for a list of names. He wanted to know which of the teachers at the school were Jewish or communists."
She paused.
"He asked about homosexuals and Freemasons, too, as if people talk about such things. You told him you didn't know."
Shame made Vian look away, but only for a second. She forced herself to say,
"I gave him your name, Rachel, along with the others."
Rachel went very still, The color drained from her face, making her dark eyes stand out.
And they fired us.
Vian swallowed hard, nodded. Rachel got to her feet and walked past Vian without stopping, ignoring her pleading.
Please, Rachel.
Pulling away so she couldn't be touched, she went into her bedroom and slammed the door shut. Time passed slowly, in indrawn breaths, and captured prayers, and creaks of the chair. Vian watched the tiny black hands on the mantel clock tick forward. She patted the baby's back in rhythm with the passing minutes. Finally, the door opened. Rachel walked back into the room. Her hair was a mess, as if she'd been shoving her hands through it. Her cheeks were blotchy, from either anxiety or anger, maybe both. Her eyes were red from crying.
I'm so sorry, Vian said, rising. Forgive me.
Rachel came to a stop in front of her, looking down at her. Anger flashed in her eyes, then faded and was replaced by resignation.
Everyone in town knows I'm a Jew, Vian. I've always been proud of it.
I know that. It's what I told myself. Still, I shouldn't have helped him. I am sorry. I wouldn't hurt you for the world. I hope you know that.
Of course I know it, Rachel said quietly. But, V, you need to be more careful. I know Beck is young and handsome and friendly and polite. But he's a Nazi, and they are dangerous.
The winter of 1940 was the coldest anyone could remember. Snow fell day after day, blanketing the trees and fields. Icicles glittered on drooping tree branches. And still, Isabel woke every Friday morning, hours before dawn, and distributed her terrorist papers, as the Nazis now called them. Last week's tract followed the military operations in North Africa and alerted the French people to the fact that the winter's food shortages were not a result of the British blockades, as Nazi propaganda insisted, but rather were caused by the Germans looting everything France produced. Isabel had been distributing these tracts for months now, and truthfully, she couldn't see that they were having much impact on the people of Karivaux. Many of the villagers still supported Pétain. Even more didn't care. A disturbing number of her neighbors looked upon the Germans and thought, so young, just boys, and went on trudging through life with their heads down, just trying to stay out of danger. The Nazis had noticed the flyers, of course. Some Frenchmen and women would use any excuse to curry favor, and giving the Nazis the flyers they found in their letterboxes was a start. Isabel knew that the Germans were looking for whoever printed and distributed the tracts, but they weren't looking too hard, especially not on these snowy days when the Blitz of London was all anyone could talk about. Perhaps the Germans knew that words on a piece of paper were not enough to turn the tide of a war. Today, Isabel lay in bed, with Sophie curled like a tiny sword fern beside her, and Vian sleeping heavily on the girl's other side. The three of them now slept together in Vian's bed. Over the past month, they'd added every quilt and blanket they could find to the bed. Isabel lay watching her breath gather and disappear in thin white clouds. She knew how cold the floor would be even through the woolen stocking she wore to bed. She knew this was the last time all day she would be warm. She steeled herself and eased out from underneath the pile of quilts. Beside her, Sophie made a moaning sound and rolled over to her mother's body for heat. When Isabel's feet hit the floor, pain shot into her shins. She winced and hobbled out of the room. The stairs took forever. Her feet hurt so badly. The damn chilblains. Everyone was suffering from them this winter. Supposedly, it was from a lack of butter and fat, but Isabel knew it was caused by cold weather and socks full of holes and shoes that were coming apart at the seams. She wanted to start a fire, ached for even a moment's warmth, really, but they were on their last bit of wood. In late January, they'd started ripping out barn wood and burning it, along with toolboxes and old chairs and whatever else they could find.
She made herself a cup of boiling water and drank it down, letting the heat and weight trick her stomach into thinking it wasn't empty. She ate a small bit of stale bread, wrapped her body in a layer of newsprint, and then put on Antoine's coat and her own mittens and boots. A woolen scarf she wrapped around her head and neck, and even so, when she stepped outside, the cold took her breath away. She closed the door behind her and trudged out into the snow, her chilblained toes throbbing with every step, her fingers going cold instantly, even inside the mittens. It was eerily quiet out here. She hiked through the knee-deep snow and opened the broken gate and stepped out onto the white-packed road. Because of the cold and snow, it took her 3 hours to deliver her papers. This week's content was about the Blitz. The Boche had dropped 32,000 bombs on London in one night alone. Dawn, when it came, was as weak as meatless broth. She was the first in line at the butcher's shop, but others soon followed. At 7 a.m., the butcher's wife rolled open the window gate and unlocked the door.
"Octopus," the woman said.
Isabel felt a pang of disappointment.
"No meat?"
"Not for the French, mademoiselle."
She heard grumbling behind her from the women who wanted meat, and farther back, from the women who knew they wouldn't even be lucky enough to get octopus. Isabel took the paper-wrapped octopus and left the shop. At least she'd gotten something. There was no tinned milk to be had anymore, not with ration cards or even on the black market. She was fortunate enough to get a little camembert after 2 more hours in line. She covered her precious items with the heavy towel in her basket and hobbled down Rue Victor Hugo. As she passed a café filled with German soldiers and French policemen, she smelled brewed coffee and freshly baked croissants, and her stomach grumbled.
"Mademoiselle."
A French policeman nodded crisply and indicated a need to step around her. She moved aside and watched him put up a poster in an abandoned storefront's window. The first poster read, "Notice. Shot for spying. The Jew Jacob Mansard, the communist Victor Yablonsky, and the Jew Louis Devry." And the second, "Notice. Henceforth, all French people arrested for any crime or infraction will be considered hostages. When a hostile act against Germany occurs in France, hostages will be shot."
"They're shooting ordinary French people for nothing?" she said.
"Don't look so pale, mademoiselle. These warnings are not for beautiful women such as yourself."
Isabel glared at the man. He was worse than the Germans. A Frenchman doing this to his own people. This was why she hated the Vichy government. What good was self-rule for half of France if it turned them into Nazi puppets?
"Are you unwell, mademoiselle?"
So solicitous, so caring. What would he do if she called him a traitor and spat in his face?
"I am fine, merci."
She watched him cross the street confidently, his back straight, his hat positioned just so on his cropped brown hair. The German soldiers in the café welcomed him warmly, clapped him on the back, and pulled him into their midst. Isabel turned away in disgust. That was when she saw it. A bright silver bicycle leaning against the side wall of the café. At the sight of it, she thought how much it would change her life, ease her pain, to ride to town and back each day. Normally a bicycle would be guarded by the soldiers in the café, but on this dark, snow-dusted morning, no one was outside at a table.
"Don't do it."
Her heart started beating, quickly. Her palms turned damp and hot within her mittens. She glanced around. The women queued up at the butcher's made it a point to see nothing and make eye contact with no one. The windows of the café across the street were fogged. Inside, the men were olive-hued silhouettes. So certain of themselves. Of us, she thought bitterly. At that, whatever sliver of restraint she possessed disappeared. She held the basket close to her side and limped out onto the ice-slicked cobblestone street. From that second, That one step forward, the world seemed to blur around her and time slowed down. She heard her breath, saw the plumes of it in front of her face. The buildings blurred or faded into white hulks, the snow dazzled, until all she could see was the glint of the silver handlebars and the two black tires. She knew there was only one way to do this, fast, without a glance sideways or a pause in her step. Somewhere a dog barked. A door banged shut. Isabel kept walking. 5 steps separated her from the bicycle. 4. 3. 2. She stepped up onto the sidewalk and took hold of the bicycle and jumped onto it. She rode down the cobblestone street, the chassis clanging at bumps in the road. She skidded around the corner, almost fell, and righted herself, pedaling hard toward Rue La Grande. There, she turned into the alley and jumped off the bicycle to knock on the door. 4 hard clacks. The door opened slowly. Henri saw her and frowned. She pushed her way inside. The small meeting room was barely lit. A single oil lamp sat on a scarred wooden table. Henri was the only one here. He was making sausage from a tray of meat and fat. Skeins of it hung from hooks on the wall. The room smelled of meat and blood and cigarette smoke. She yanked the bicycle in with her and slammed the door shut. "Well, hello," he said, wiping his hands on a towel. "Have we called a meeting I don't know about?"
"No."
He glanced at her side.
"That's not your bicycle."
"I stole it," she said, "from right under their noses."
"It is, or was, Alain Deschamps' bicycle. He left everything and fled to Lyon with his family when the occupation began."
He moved toward her.
"Lately I have been seeing an SS soldier riding it around town."
"SS?"
Isabel's elation faded. There were ugly rumors swirling about the SS and their cruelty. Perhaps she should have thought this through. He moved closer, so close she could feel the warmth of his body. She had never been alone with him before, nor so near him. She saw for the first time that his eyes were neither brown nor green, but rather a hazel gray that made her think of fog in a deep forest. She saw a small scar at his brow that had either been a terrible gash at one time or poorly stitched, and it made her wonder all at once what kind of life he'd led that had brought him here and to communism. He was older than she by at least a decade, although, to be honest, he seemed even older sometimes, as if perhaps he'd suffered a great loss.
"You'll need to paint it," he said.
"I don't have any paint."
"I do."
"Would you?"
"A kiss," he said.
"A kiss?"
She repeated it to stall for time. This was the sort of thing that she'd taken for granted before the war. Men desired her. They always had. She wanted that back, wanted to flirt with Henri and be flirted with, and yet the very idea of it felt sad and a little lost, as if perhaps kisses didn't mean much anymore, and flirtation even less.
"One kiss and I'll paint your bicycle tonight, and you can pick it up tomorrow."
She stepped toward him and tilted her face up to his. They came together easily, even with all the coats and layers of newsprint and wool between them. He took her in his arms and kissed her. For a beautiful second, she was Isabel Rossignol again, the passionate girl whom men desired. When it ended and he drew back, she felt deflated, sad. She should say something, make a joke, or perhaps pretend that she felt more than she did. That's what she would have done before, when kisses had meant more, or maybe less.
"There's someone else," Henri said, studying her intently.
"No, there isn't."
Henri touched her cheek gently.
"You're lying."
Isabel thought of all that Henri had given her. He was the one who'd brought her into the Free French Network and given her a chance. He was the one who believed in her. And yet, when he kissed her, she thought of Gaetan.
"He didn't want me," she said.
It was the first time she'd told anyone the truth. The admission surprised her.
If things were different, I'd make you forget him.
And I'd let you try.
She saw the way he smiled at that, saw the sorrow in it.
Blue, he said after a pause.
Blue?
It's the paint color I have.
Isabel smiled.
How fitting.
Later that day, as she stood in one line after another for too little food, and then as she gathered wood from the forest and carried it home, she thought about that kiss. What she thought, over and over again, was, if only.
Chapter 13. On a beautiful day in late April of 1941, Isabel lay stretched out on a woolen blanket in the field across from the house. The sweet smell of ripening hay filled her nostrils. When she closed her eyes, she could almost forget that the engines in the distance were German lorries taking soldiers and France's produce to the train station at Tours. After the disastrous winter, she appreciated how the sunshine lulled her into a drowsy state.
There you are.
Isabel sighed and sat up. Vianne wore a faded blue gingham day dress that had been grayed by harsh homemade soap. Hunger had whittled her down over the winter, sharpened her cheekbones, and deepened the hollow at the base of her throat. An old scarf turbaned her head, hiding hair that had lost its shine and curl.
This came for you.
Vianne held out a piece of paper.
It was delivered by a man.
For you, she said, as if that fact bore repeating. Isabel clambered awkwardly to her feet and snatched the paper from Vianne's grasp. On it, in scrawled handwriting, was, "The curtains are open." She reached down for her blanket and began folding it up. What did it mean? They'd never summoned her before. Something important must be happening.
Isabel, would you care to explain?
No.
It was Henri Navarre, the innkeeper's son. I didn't think you knew him.
Isabel ripped the note into tiny pieces and let it fall away.
He's a communist, you know, Vianne said in a whisper. I need to go.
Vianne grabbed her wrist.
You cannot have been sneaking out all winter to see a communist. You know what the Nazis think of them. It's dangerous to even be seen with this man.
You think I care what the Nazis think?
Isabel said, wrenching free. She ran barefooted across the field. At home, she grabbed some shoes and climbed aboard her bicycle. With an
au revoir
to a stunned-looking Vianne, Isabel was off, pedaling down the dirt road. In town, she coasted past the abandoned hat shop. Sure enough, the curtains were open, and veered into the cobblestone alley and came to a stop. She leaned her bicycle against the rough limestone wall beside her and rapped four times. It didn't occur to her until the final knock that it might be a trap. The idea, when it came, made her draw in a sharp breath and glance left and right, but it was too late now. Henri opened the door. Isabel ducked inside. The room was hazy with cigarette smoke and reeked of burnt chicory coffee. There was about the place a lingering scent of blood, sausage making. The burly man who had first grabbed her, Didier, was seated on an old hickory-backed chair. He was leaning back so far the two front chair legs were off the floor and his back grazed the wall behind him.
You shouldn't have brought a notice to my house, Henri. My sister is asking questions.
It was important we talk to you immediately.
Isabel felt a little bump of excitement. Would they finally ask her to do something more than dropping papers in letterboxes?
I am here.
Henri lit up a cigarette. She could feel him watching her as he exhaled the gray smoke and put down his match.
Have you heard of a prefect in Chartres who was arrested and tortured for being a communist?
Isabel frowned.
No.
He cut his own throat with a piece of glass rather than name anyone or confess.
Henri snubbed his cigarette out on the bottom of his shoe and saved the rest for later in his coat pocket.
He is putting a group together of people like us who want to heed de Gaulle's call. He, the one who cut his own throat, is trying to get to London to speak to de Gaulle himself. He seeks to organize a Free French movement.
He didn't die? Isabel asked. Or cut his vocal cords?
No, they're calling it a miracle,
Didier said. Henri studied Isabel.
I have a letter, very important, that needs to be delivered to our contact in Paris. Unfortunately, I am being watched closely these days, as is Didier.
Oh, Isabel said.
I thought of you,
Didier said.
Me?
Henri reached into his pocket and withdrew a crumpled envelope.
Will you deliver this to our man in Paris? He is expecting it a week from today.
But I don't have an Ausweis.
Oui, Henri said quietly. And if you were caught?
He let that threat dangle.
Certainly no one would think badly of you if you declined. This is dangerous.
Dangerous was an understatement. There were signs posted throughout Carrivaux about executions that were taking place all over the occupied zone. The Nazis were killing French citizens for the smallest of infractions. Aiding this Free French movement could get her imprisoned at the very least. Still, she believed in a free France the way her sister believed in God.
So you want me to get a pass, go to Paris, deliver a letter, and come home?
It didn't sound so perilous when put that way.
No, Henri said. We need you to stay in Paris and be our letterbox, as it were. In the coming months, there will be many such deliveries. Your father has an apartment there, oui?
Paris. It was what she'd longed for from the moment her father had exiled her. To leave Carrivaux and return to Paris, and to be part of a network of people who resisted this war.
My father will not offer me a place to stay.
Convince him otherwise,
Didier said evenly, watching her, judging her.
He is not a man who is easily convinced, she said.
So you can't do it. Voila, we have our answer.
Wait,
Isabel said. Henri approached her. She saw reluctance in his eyes and knew that he wanted her to turn down this assignment. No doubt he was worried about her. She lifted her chin and looked him in the eyes.
I will do this.
You will have to lie to everyone you love and always be afraid. Can you live that way? You'll not feel safe anywhere.
Isabel laughed grimly. It was not so different from the life she'd lived since she was a little girl.
Will you watch over my sister? She asked Henri. Make sure she's safe?
There is a price for all our work, Henri said.
He gave her a sad look. In it was the truth they had all learned. There was no safety.
I hope you see that.
All Isabel saw was her chance to do something that mattered.
When do I leave?
As soon as you get an Ausweis, which will not be easy.
What in heaven's name is that girl thinking?
Really, a schoolyard-style note from a man? A communist? Vianne unwrapped the stringy piece of mutton that had been this week's ration and set it on the kitchen counter. Isabel had always been impetuous. A force of nature, really. A girl who liked to break rules. Countless nuns and teachers had learned that she could be neither controlled nor contained. But this was not kissing a boy on the dance floor or running away to see the circus or refusing to wear a girdle and stockings. This was wartime in an occupied country. How could Isabel still believe that her choices had no consequences? Vianne began finally chopping the mutton. She added a precious egg to the mix and stale bread, then seasoned it with salt and pepper. She was forming the mixture into patties when she heard a motorcycle putt-puttering toward the house. She went to the front door and opened it just enough to peer out. Captain Beck's head and shoulders could be seen above the stone wall as he dismounted his motorcycle. Moments later, a green military lorry pulled up behind him and parked. Three other German soldiers appeared in her yard. The men talked among themselves and then gathered at the rose-covered stone wall her great-great-grandfather had built. One of the soldiers lifted a sledgehammer and brought it down hard on the wall, which shattered. Stones broke into pieces. A skein of roses fell, their pink petals scattering across the grass. Vianne rushed out into her yard.
Herr Captain!
The sledgehammer came down again. Crack!
Madame, Beck said, looking unhappy.
It bothered Vianne that she knew him well enough to notice his state of mind.
We have orders to tear down all the walls along this road.
As one soldier demolished the wall, two others came toward the front door, laughing at some joke between them. Without asking permission, they walked past her and went into her house.
My condolences, Beck said, stepping over the rubble on his way to her. I know you love the roses, and, most sorrowfully, my men will be fulfilling a requisition order from your house.
A requisition?
The soldiers came out of the house. One carried the oil painting that had been over the mantel, and the other had the overstuffed chair from the salon.
That was my grandmère's favorite chair,
Vian said quietly.
I'm sorry, Beck said. I was unable to stop this.
What in the world?
Vian didn't know whether to be relieved or concerned when Isabel yanked her bike over the pile of stone and leaned it against the tree. Already there was no barrier between her property and the road anymore. Isabel looked beautiful, even with her face pink from the exertion of riding her bicycle and shiny with perspiration. Glossy blonde waves framed her face. Her faded red dress clung to her body in all the right places. The soldiers stopped to stare at her. The rolled-up Aubusson rug from the living room slung between them. Beck removed his military cap. He said something to the soldiers who were carrying the rolled-up carpet, and they hurried toward the lorry.
You've torn down our wall?
Isabel said.
The Sturmbannführer wants to be able to see all houses from the road. Somebody is distributing anti-German propaganda. We shall find and arrest him.
You think harmless pieces of paper are worth all of this?
Isabel asked.
They are far from harmless, mademoiselle. They encourage terrorism.
Terrorism must be avoided, Isabel said, crossing her arms.
Vianne couldn't look away from Isabel. There was something going on. Her sister seemed to be drawing her emotions back, going still, like a cat preparing to pounce.
Herr Captain,
Isabel said after a while.
Oui, mademoiselle.
Soldiers walked past them, carrying out the breakfast table. Isabel let them pass and then walked to the captain.
My papa is ill. He is?
Vianne said.
Why don't I know this? What's wrong with him?
Isabel ignored Vianne.
He has asked that I come to Paris to nurse him, but... He wants you to nurse him?
Vianne said, incredulous. Beck said,
You need a travel pass to leave, mademoiselle. You know this.
I know this.
Isabel seemed to barely breathe.
I thought perhaps you would procure one for me. You are a family man. Certainly you understand how important it is to answer a father's call.
Strangely, as Isabel spoke, the captain turned slightly to look at Vianne, as if she were the one who mattered.
I could get you a pass, oui,
the captain said.
For a family emergency such as this.
I am grateful, Isabel said.
Vianne was stunned. Did Beck not see how her sister was manipulating him? And why had he looked at Vian when making his decision? As soon as Isabel got what she wanted, she returned to her bicycle. She took hold of the handlebars and walked it toward the barn. The rubber wheels bumped and thumped on the uneven ground. Vian rushed after her.
"Papa's ill?"
she said when she caught up with her sister.
"Papa's fine." "You lied? Why?"
Isabel's pause was slight but perceptible. "I suppose there is no reason to lie. It's all out in the open now. I have been sneaking out on Friday mornings to meet Henri, and now he has asked me to go to Paris with him. He has a lovely little pied-à-terre in the Montmartre, apparently."
"Are you mad?"
"I am in love, I think. A little. Maybe. You are going to cross Nazi-occupied France to spend a few nights in Paris in the bed of a man whom you might love a little." "I know," Isabel said. "It's so romantic."
"You must be feverish. Perhaps you have a brain sickness of some kind."
She put her hands on her hips and made a huff of disapproval.
"If love is a disease, I suppose I'm infected." "Good God!" Vian crossed her arms. "Is there anything I can say to stop this foolishness?"
Isabel looked at her.
"You believe me? You believe I would cross Nazi-occupied France on a lark? This is not like running away to see the circus, Isabel. But you believe this of me?"
"Of course," Vian shrugged.
"So foolish."
Isabel looked oddly crestfallen.
"Just stay away from Beck while I'm gone. Don't trust him." "Isn't that just like you? You're worried enough to warn me, but not worried enough to stay with me. What you want is really what matters. Sophie and I can rot for all you care." "That's not true." "Isn't it? Go to Paris. Have your fun, but don't for one minute forget that you are abandoning your niece and me."
Vian crossed her arms and glanced back at the man in her yard, who was supervising the looting of her house.
"With him."
Chapter 14. April 27th, 1995. The Oregon Coast.
I am trussed up like a chicken for roasting. I know these modern seat belts are a good thing, but they make me feel claustrophobic. I belong to a generation that didn't expect to be protected from every danger. I remember what it used to be like back in the days when one was required to make smart choices. We knew the risks and took them anyway. I remember driving too fast in my old Chevrolet, my foot pressed hard on the gas, smoking a cigarette and listening to Price sing "Lordy, Miss Claudie" through small black speakers while children rolled around in the back seat like bowling pins. My son is afraid that I will make a break for it, I suppose, and it is a reasonable fear. In the past month, my entire life has been turned upside down. There is a sold sign in my front yard, and I am leaving home.
"It's a pretty driveway, don't you think?"
my son says. It's what he does. He fills space with words, and he chooses them carefully. It is what makes him a good surgeon. Precision. "Yes."
He turns into the parking lot. Like the driveway, it is lined in flowering trees. Tiny white blossoms drop to the ground like bits of lace on a dressmaker's floor, stark against the black asphalt. I fumble with my seatbelt as we park. My hands do not obey my will these days. It frustrates me so much that I curse out loud. "I'll do that," my son says, reaching sideways to unhook my seatbelt. He is out of the automobile and at my door before I have even retrieved my handbag. The door opens. He takes me by the hand and helps me out of the car. In the short distance between the parking lot and the entrance, I have to stop twice to catch my breath.
The trees are so pretty this time of year, he says as we walk together across the parking lot.
Yes. They are flowering plum trees, gorgeous and pink, but I think suddenly of chestnut trees in bloom along the Champs-Élysées. My son tightens his hold on my hand. It is a reminder that he understands the pain of leaving a home that has been my sanctuary for nearly 50 years. But now it is time to look ahead, not behind. To the Ocean Crest Retirement Community and Nursing Home. To be fair, it doesn't look like a bad place. A little industrial, maybe, with its rigidly upright windows and perfectly maintained patch of grass out front and the American flag flying above the door. It is a long, low building, built in the 70s, I'd guess, back when just about everything was ugly. There are two wings that reach out from a central courtyard, where I imagine old people sit in wheelchairs with their faces turned to the sun, waiting. Thank God I am not housed in the east side of the building, the nursing home wing. Not yet, anyway. I can still manage my own life, thank you very much, and my own apartment. Julian opens the door for me, and I go inside. The first thing I see is a large reception area decorated to look like the hospitality desk of a seaside hotel, complete with a fishing net full of shells hung on the wall. I imagine that at Christmas they hang ornaments from the netting and stockings from the edge of the desk. There are probably sparkly ho-ho-ho signs tacked up to the wall on the day after Thanksgiving.
Come on, Mom.
Oh, right. Mustn't dawdle. The place smells of what? Tapioca pudding and chicken noodle soup. Soft foods. Somehow I keep going. If there's one thing I never do, it's stop.
Here we are, my son says, opening the door to room 317A.
It's nice, honestly. A small, one-bedroom apartment. The kitchen is tucked into the corner by the door, and from it one can look out over a formica counter and see a dining table with four chairs and the living room, where a coffee table and sofa and two chairs are gathered around a gas fireplace. The TV in the corner is brand new, with a built-in VCR player. Someone, my son probably, has stacked a bunch of my favorite movies in the bookcase. Jean de Florette, Breathless, Gone with the Wind. I see my things. An afghan I knitted thrown over the sofa's back. My books in the bookcase. In the bedroom, which is of a fine size, the nightstand on my side of the bed is lined with prescription pill containers, a little jungle of plastic orange cylinders. My side of the bed. It's funny, but some things don't change after the death of a spouse, and that's one of them. The left side of the bed is mine, even though I'm alone in it. At the foot of the bed is my trunk, just as I have requested.
You could still change your mind, he says quietly. Come home with me.
We've talked about this, Julian. Your life is too busy. You needn't worry about me 24/7.
Do you think I will worry less when you are here?
I look at him, loving this child of mine and knowing my death will devastate him. I don't want him to watch me die by degrees. I don't want that for his daughters either. I know what it is like. Some images, once seen, can never be forgotten. I want them to remember me as I am, not as I will be when the cancer has had its way. He leads me into the small living room and gets me settled on the couch. While I wait, he pours us some wine and then sits beside me. I am thinking of how it will feel when he leaves, and I'm sure the same thought occupies his mind. With a sigh, he reaches into his briefcase and pulls out a stack of envelopes. The sigh is in place of words, a breath of transition. In it, I hear that moment where I go from one life to another. In this new, pared-down version of my life, I am to be cared for by my son instead of vice versa. It's not really comfortable for either of us. I've paid this month's bills. These are things I don't know what to do with. Junk, mostly, I think. I take the stack of letters from him and shuffle through them. A personalized letter from the Special Olympics Committee. A free estimate awning offer. A notice from my dentist that it has been 6 months since my last appointment. A letter from Paris. There are red markings on it, as if the post office has shuffled it around from place to place or delivered it incorrectly. "Mom?" Julian says. He is so observant. He misses nothing.
"What is that?"
When he reaches for the envelope, I mean to hold on to it, keep it from him, but my fingers don't obey my will. My heartbeat is going all which-a-way. Julian opens the envelope, extracts an écru card. An invitation.
"It's in French," he says. "Something about the Croix de Guerre. So it's about World War II? Is this for Dad?"
Of course. Men always think war is all about them.
And there's something handwritten in the corner. What is it?
Guerre. The word expands around me, unfolds its black crow wings, becoming so big I cannot look away. Against my will, I take up the invitation. It is to a passeurs' reunion in Paris. They want me to attend. How can I possibly go without remembering all of it? The terrible things I have done, the secret I kept, the man I killed, and the one I should have.
"Mom, what's a passeur?"
I can hardly find enough voice to say. It's someone who helped people. In the war,